God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. What would be the modern equivalent to that test? Or is there one? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host for commentary and discussion, applying God's Word to issues of daily living. Joining me for conversations are Larry Vavirka and Paul Dibdall, two colleagues of mine from the School of Theology. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Alden.
Thank you.
Let's go to that question, story of Abraham and Isaac, and let's start there. Is there a modern equivalent, or is that something that applied only to our good brother Abraham? And nothing like that will ever come close to any of us.
I think we could perhaps hope that nothing similar to that would ever come close.
I used to hope that when I was a kid, hoping my dad would never get a vision.
Yeah, but I don't know that it would be safe to say that nothing like that will ever necessarily come close to us. I think it is tough, though, probably to find a precise equivalent to that, and who would be able to judge what exactly would be an equivalent even.
There's no greater loss to be experienced than the loss of a child. And that's, but you ramp it up a step when you say you intentionally cause the loss of that child or intentionally sacrifice the life of that child.
Now, is that what makes this story such a tough one? A, you have to take the life of the child, and B, it is God who has commanded you to do that. Is that why we keep coming back again and again to this troubling story?
Well, maybe, but it's so profoundly different to us and our culture. I mean, for him, that was commonplace. Mm-hmm. What greater gift could one give than one's child? And but if you ask me that question, what's the greatest gift I could give to God? And the only thing that circles around in my mind is somehow myself, but and maybe some of us do that in a way by the vocational choices that we make to give ourselves or give our lives to God. But and there may be some sacrifice in that, but it's hard to find equivalent terms.
Yeah.
But isn't it more difficult to see a loved one suffer than to suffer yourself?
I think so.
Well, and I add to that that the person, the loved one, is suffering because of, say, a choice or a bad choice that we might have made.
Yeah. I remember when our older daughter was diagnosed with juvenile onset diabetes. She was 19. She seemed to handle it pretty well. But, boy, that was tough on me, thinking that here my daughter's going to have to take a needle 3 times a day for the rest of her life. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So the vicarious, you know, you're suffering through someone that you love. It's part of your community. But I think, Larry, maybe we could bind this one off. We want to go to several other incidents of deep trouble, which this whole lesson clusters about. I think maybe your suggestion that it made sense in that culture, child sacrifice was widely practiced. We know that in the Old Testament. That's why Abraham doesn't quarrel with it. But God uses that incident then to teach Abraham, you can't really sacrifice your son. I will provide the sacrifice for you. Now, it probably didn't sound quite that way to him, but it can sound that way to us living on this side of the cross, where it's clear that God provides the sacrifice, that there's no way that we can convince God to save us. It's his decision, not ours. So, that's one example of, extreme heat, to use the title of our discussions for this time. But now let's go to another one, which is troubling in quite a different direction. Hosea, the prophet Hosea, had a wife who was not faithful. And Hosea is instructed by the Lord to go bring her back. She's out playing the town. Now you go bring her back. Is that advisable for a preacher?
Yeah, it's just last quarter, the lessons talked about couples in the Bible, and this was one of the couples that was some of you may remember studying even. And I don't know, in working through that lesson, I felt like I ended up with more questions than a lot of answers to it. Both the different ways that Hosea tries to win her back, God asking Hosea to marry Gomer to begin with. So I'm just maybe asking not quite the same question, but just saying, yes, that's a good question, Alden.
I mean, we would not probably very often put up with a pastor who has that degree of family dysfunction.
And that could be said, though, about a number of families, I suppose, in the Old Testament.
Oh.
Well, I wonder. I think I'm aware of cases where the pastor is not the one who is leaving the home for whatever reason. And many times that pastor will remain in good and regular standing and may continue in ministry if the pastor himself is the one who's out playing unfaithfulness. However you want to describe that.
You're trying to be diplomatic, Larry, and kind of running out of words there.
Right. Then the response has been very different, at least I've observed. So I'm not so sure that we would chastise pastors for having problems go on in their families. Do we? Do we do that?
No, but it certainly is incredibly difficult when that happens.
Maybe not chastise in an official way always, but I think there is a certain price that people pay, whether or not it's some official action of the church or the community.
Now, Larry, let me ask you current wisdom from a counseling perspective. I have heard it said that there is no innocent party in a divorce.
Oh, I think as a general rule of thumb that that still is true, that relationships are made up of more than one individual. But yeah, I would hate to generalize that in some sort of firm and fast sort of way. But,
see, because the nasty side of that is that if a spouse disappears and you can point the finger at the other one and said, well, you drove them away. And that's not helpful.
No, and it's off. It is always. Oh, I think always would be a fair word here. Always an incredibly complicated set of circumstances and interactions, and I think there is a truth too that learning can occur, that better ways of functioning can occur, and certainly I think couples ought to, as a kind of moral responsibility, avail themselves of every opportunity to learn and grow through these things. But there are complicating factors in that, too. Some people just don't seem to be open to learning or are so rigidly mired in certain ways of doing things that they have trouble.
Now, the reason why this particular crucible is such a crucial one is that you're dealing with human beings who, in theory, if they could just see the light, they could come back and everyone would live happily ever after. But how do you do that? And if you think of a wayward child or a wayward spouse, how in the world do you grab them by the scruff of the neck and shake the stuffings out of them or bribe them? And that's maybe just a couple of minutes here on what Hosea did first.
Well, kind of the tough love approach initially, right?
Yeah, really tough initially. Take everything away.
And then when that didn't work or didn't seem to work, just the opposite of that, showering Gomer with gifts and so
yeah.
forth.
Generally, which works better, Larry? You're the counselor.
Oh, my. So people are so different. I mean, some will respond to one and others to another. The picture that is most helpful here, I think, is having infinite patience and never giving up on people or but to constantly be I think even experimenting to see what is going to be the motivational factor that helps them either face the reality of what they're doing or communicates best that they are loved. And
sometimes either one works. As Jesus says, we piped, we didn't dance, we mourn. You know, it didn't make any difference what we did. See? So, but I do think the positive thing of this one is that the Lord did not give up on Gomer, and the Lord did not give up on Hosea. So he's there, and I think that's very helpful. Now, let's go to another famous passage here, and we're going to have to skip over a couple of them. Paul went through all kinds of hell. Job went through similar difficulties. But I'd like for us to go to a psalm. No, not a psalm. Isaiah 43, which is a famous psalm-like passage, a promise that God gives to us. At least it sounds like a promise. Let me just read the key words here in Isaiah 43, verse 2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. What does that verse mean when you go to a situation like Rwanda, where you have faithful people being slaughtered for nothing that they have done? What does a promise like this mean in the Bible?
In a certain sense, I think that we would need to ask the people who have been through those incredibly difficult situations. Obviously, we wouldn't be able to talk to those who were slaughtered, but there have been people who have been burned, who have suffered incredibly and unfairly. And from my perspective, I would tend to look at this and say, well, boy, that, you know, these are great words, but it doesn't always happen this way. There are times where people walk through the fire and they are burned and the water does sweep over them and sweep them away. That's one way of looking at it. But I think the testimony of those who've been through that kind of situation would probably be important for someone like me to listen to. And maybe that's key too. Is this a promise or is this a testimony?
I really like that word testimony, Paul, because it suggests, and probably all of us have had those moments where we've sensed God's presence and we burst out into exuberance, which probably exceeds the actual facts. Our time is up. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Paul. And thank you to our program engineer, John Campbell, for the good word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.